So welcome to today's Leadership Forum, whether you're here at the Institute or whether you're on the webinar. My name is Gloria Yu. I'm a director at Deloitte and I'll be chairing the session today. I lead the Institute's mentoring working group and I served on the Leadership and Career Development Committee for a number of years. So I'm very passionate about the topic of leadership. So I think it's great that we can gather together and then have forums like these to really chat about leadership and what it means for actuaries. I'm sure you'd agree with me that there are many advantages of being an actuary. And one of those is that we've got skills that are transferable, whether it's across industries or geographic regions or the like. But how do we realise that advantage? And what does it look like practically? What are some of the challenges that are along the way? And how do leadership skills fit into all this? So today we have two special speakers. We've got Julia Lessing and Kirsten Armstrong, and they will be sharing with us their journey in breaking the actuarial mold. We're going to have opportunities for Q&A at the end, so I really encourage you to think through, you know, what kind of questions you have, and we're going to keep it interactive later on as well. So just a little bit about our speakers. Julia Lessing is a qualified actuary and a mum of four. Her actuarial journey started at Macquarie University 20 years ago after her careers advisor suggested that her good results in maths meant she could pursue actuarial studies or high school teaching. She chose actuarial. Good choice. Today she runs a boutique consulting firm, Guardian Actuarial, where she applies her actuarial and other skills to a range of business problems, including advice on government service delivery, workforce planning, and export witness services. While her friends and family still don't really know what actuaries do, Julia finds it easier to explain what she does in her current role. However, sometimes she finds it harder to explain what she does to actuaries. Kirsten Armstrong is currently the Director of Knowledge and Innovation at the Fred Hollows Foundation. She leads a team of researchers, economists, and development specialists to strengthen program performance, drive innovation, and deepen the use of evidence and demonstrate impact. She's also a board director at Northcott, one of Australia's leading providers of disability services, and was previously a partner at PwC. Would you please welcome our two speakers?
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Gloria. I'm really excited to be here talking to you guys today, and I don't know if you've ever been in one of Martin Mulcair's sessions on facilitation and around putting presentations together, but I always remember that when he's spoken before on this topic, it's always about understanding your audience. So when I was preparing this and Kirsten and I were doing our preparation for today, we were asking ourselves, what is it that everyone's coming for today? Is it for free sandwiches and four CPD points? Maybe. What do people think about the actuarial mould? What is it? Are people already breaking the actuarial mould or are they coming here for some inspiration? And I've spoken to a few of you over lunch and I think there's a bit of a mix there. So hopefully our presentations together will give you some good inspiration on how you might break the actuarial mould. But obviously there's some of you who have already broken the mould and are already doing some really exciting things in different fields. So I'm also keen to hear about your adventures as well. So when I think about the actuarial mould, this is kind of what I think about a traditional actuarial career. So we might be in corporate roles, we might be in consulting. We think about it as sort of a linear ladder type pathway through our careers, starting at the bottom where we're the doers, the students or the consultants or the analysts, and moving our way up this ladder, often in a traditional actuarial field like insurance or banking or superannuation. And I don't know why we think this way, but one thing that does come to mind is that we have a very linear career, a very linear education path, and I think sometimes that linear education path keeps us in that mindset and we keep that mindset into our careers. We think that our careers will also be linear and it's a set of hoops and a set of progress up some sort of ladder. And the reason I think this is interesting is because when people ask me about how I've broken the actuarial mould, sometimes they're asking questions about how I've gotten off this ladder, how I've gotten off this linear path. So in lots of ways, my own career path has not been linear. It's kind of a bit more like a blob. In fact, when I started as a graduate actuary, I was already a mum of three. So I'd had my study was undertaken while I was raising a young family, and I had roles as a stay-at-home parent as well as roles in the community like being a breastfeeding counsellor for new mothers. And as I progressed through my professional career, juggling babies and work and actuarial exams, I picked up a whole lot of sideline activities that I was interested in. For example, volunteering for the Institute. Things that I liked though, so going back to my old high school and talking to the students about what it was like to be an actuary. When I was on maternity leave with my fourth baby, I became a Tupperware sales demonstrator to help learn some sales skills and also get a whole lot of great plastic for my cupboard. And then later on down the track, I also trained as a volunteer counsellor for Lifeline. Just felt a calling to do that work. So I didn't do all these things to sort of like further my career specifically, but looking back now, I realise that all of those different things that I've had as that portfolio of my career has built, they've all helped me in some way. They've either given me skills that I wouldn't have developed through the formal actuarial study and work pathway, or they've built my network into areas of interest for me. So today, I use a combination of actuarial skills, a whole lot of other skills that I've learnt along the way, and I apply them to business problems in both traditional areas, so we have clients who are insurance companies, and also new areas like state government, non-government organisations, other industries like waste management, and last year we helped Macquarie University put together their co-op scholarship program. So when I think about breaking the actuarial mould, I think this kind of view is helpful when we're thinking about our careers. So the dark blue hexagons are roles that we might consider as sort of typical inside the actuarial mould. The green or teal hexagons are sort of related roles that actuaries might act in, and the light blue ones are unpaid or unrelated roles for actuaries. So you get the idea that our careers are not necessarily linear, and if we think outside that linear pathway, but also more broadly outside of just what's traditional actuarial, there's lots of different ways that we can build our careers and break that actuarial mould. So you might just be here for a free lunch and four CPD points, but I'm going to assume that you are interested in some learnings from my own experience. So I'm going to share with you my top five tips about how you might break the actuarial mould if you haven't already. So the first tip is to follow your interests, because why would you want to break a perfectly good, well-paid actuarial mould to do something that you're not interested in? First tip is to think about what you're interested in and to follow that. So at work, we're all good at maths. We're all actuaries or analysts. We're all good at maths, but what else are you interested in? Outside of work, I'm passionate about people and communities and families, and I'm curious about how we can work together to make the world a better place. So at work, I've always enjoyed the people side of things, the career counselling, the client management, probably why I've had a career in consulting primarily. So I try and take more roles that are sort of aligned with those interests. And then outside of work, I've taken roles to help people in the community like my breastfeeding counselling and my Lifeline work as well. So the first tip is to follow your interests. The second tip is to volunteer. So I've talked and written about this before, but I honestly think that the most efficient way to accelerate your career is to volunteer. I'm going to say that again. The most efficient way to accelerate your career is to volunteer. Volunteering gives you access to things that you wouldn't be able to do necessarily as part of your current paid role. It might give you the opportunity to learn, if you're on an institute committee, how to participate or chair a committee. You might not be up to that at work. It might give you an opportunity to broaden your horizons and learn more about a different field or a different industry, build your network. So personally, I've done a lot of volunteering, and I know Kirsten will talk about that as well, through institute activities, but also within my workplace and also in my community. So volunteer, at work or outside. My third tip is to keep learning. I know it's tempting once you finish those dreaded Part 3 exams to loudly proclaim, I'm never studying ever again. But breaking the mould might mean that you need to upskill, and nothing is going to be as bad as those Part 3 exams. And I know that there's a few of you who are already doing some extra study in different fields and can understand what I'm saying firsthand. So for me, that meant that my bookshelf broadened somewhat from some familiar books there that you've probably got on yours to a much broader set of reading material on the right. So it might be about enrolling in different courses, formal education, but it might also just be subscribing to some new magazines, reading some more books, reading more widely. But be careful not to bite off more than you can chew. While it's not impossible, it will be difficult for us, many of us, to go from being, say, a qualified actuary working in life insurance to a mental health psychologist in a hospital. Sorts of big changes in terms of skill set and industry are very difficult to make in one move. So my fourth tip is to build on what you're already good at. And if you have a look at the matrix I've got up here, let's assume that when we qualify, we're in that bottom left-hand corner. So we've got current skills, current industry. For most actuaries, that's going to be some sort of traditional actuarial skills in a traditional kind of industry, insurance skills perhaps. You probably don't want to move from, take that red arrow into additional skills and additional in a different industry. So you might want to take that kind of one step at a time, an analysis of profit for your career, if you like. So for me, what I did was I started in that current state, the bottom left-hand corner, and then I used the skills that I learnt through my volunteering, my counselling skills, my management skills, my herding cat skills that I have with four children at home, and brought those to my workplace and was known as a good project manager, a good people manager. And that reputation and that those extra skills that I had beyond my technical skills, which were given, gave me the opportunity to move into a new industry and to manage a project outside of insurance. So my pathway was kind of to the right and then up. You could take other directions through that, but my tip would be to break it down. The final tip I have is to grow your network. So if you're following your interests, you're volunteering, you're learning more things, this isn't going to be very difficult. It will happen quite naturally. But don't forget your existing network. When I first started Guardian Actuarial, my very first employee was a fellow life insurance actuary from the days when we were both traditional life insurance actuaries, not someone in a different field. So I'd started the business, she approached me, said she was looking for something different, and the rest is history. So it's important when you're breaking that mould and moving outside that you don't put those contacts behind you, I suppose, but recognise that people move around and that's still worth building on that network and investing in your network. Your new network will grow as you keep following your interests, volunteering, keeping learning, building on what you're good at. And I've found that writing and sharing content can be quite helpful in terms of raising my profile and also building my network. So Actuaries Digital will often run short articles, but LinkedIn can be a good platform for writing and sharing content as well. So in summary, I've got five tips to get you cracking open that actuarial mould. Stick to what you're interested in. There's no point breaking a perfectly good actuarial mould to do something you hate. Volunteer either at work or in your community. Keep learning. Nothing will be as hard as those part threes, whether it's formal education, so don't be afraid to enrol in something or just to read more widely. Build on what you're already good at. Take some side steps in your career and forget about that linear career path. Grow your network. Share what you're interested in. Talk to people in your new fields and have some fun.
Julia, you're a tough act to follow. I'm a little nervous now.
Thank you, everyone. So I am the Director of Knowledge and Innovation at the Fred Hollows Foundation, which is a really unusual job title, I think, for an actuary. And most people don't know what it means, which is good. But basically my role now at the Fred Hollows Foundation is a mixture of strategy, research, innovation. You know, for example, we might be developing new medical products to bring down the cost of eye care in the countries we work in, bringing in impact investors into eye care, and a whole range of different things. So anything that sort of sounds a little bit tricky, sounds a little bit hard, might involve talking to commercial people, anything along those lines ends up in my court. And about a year ago, passing someone in the corridor, and they kind of said, "Oh, give that one to Kirsten. She's the innovative one." And I never thought, as an actuary, that I would ever hear someone say that about me. And it's stuck with me for a while. And I think thinking about your journey and where things go, it is about understanding what you're good at and understanding what your skills are and how other people perceive those. That is where the real opportunities to make a difference come from. So my career journey in logos, I started life as a superannuation actuary at AMP back many, many, many years ago. And, you know, secretly the main reason I had become an actuary and made that decision at all of the age of 16, I think, when I sort of wrote down on the bit of paper back when, this is a real secret about to come out, back when I was in Queensland. Making a decision about my career choice. My key focus was actually what university course was sort of maths focus that made sense for me, but ensured I didn't have to move to Brisbane. And as it turns out, at that time, Sydney and Melbourne were the only options to study to become an actuary. So in fact, my career choice was a little bit focused on really what got me out of Queensland. So when I first started at AMP, some 4 years later, I'd been lucky enough to have a scholarship with them. I know they're not so common now, but I was very lucky to have a scholarship with AMP, and I think my first sort of discussion with them around my job was actually I said to them, I don't actually think I want to be an actuary. So as you imagine, they were feeling pretty upset about the fact that they've just supported my degree for 4 years and I walk in and have this conversation. But the key at that point in time was that I was true to myself and I really was not sure that it was the career for me. Lots of discussions about, you know, what to do with me. I was very fortunate at the time that John Moroney, who subsequently became CEO of the Institute here, was working for AMP at that time in a government relations role. And he was keen to have someone who was, a junior actuary come to support that team. In terms of government relations. So at the time, superannuation, the details and rules around compulsory superannuation were being bedded down in Australia. So AMP, on behalf of the life insurance and superannuation industry, was really lobbying hard to get the outcomes that they wanted as all the details of compulsory superannuation were bedded down. So for me, that was staying true to myself and being honest about what I thought I brought and what I really wanted to do was an absolute goldmine because I had an opportunity to work with someone fantastic, John Moroney, and also an opportunity to work in a government relations, government policy sort of role, lobbying government and so on. And I think, you know, for me, that then became a really critical part of my entire career. So I guess one of my tips from that is actually, you know, find the things as you go along that you're learning that may not be the most obvious things along the way and grab them and learn as much as you can from them and take the opportunity to learn from any manager that you work with along the way because they've always got something new and different to bring to the table. So after AMP, I briefly, I'm just looking at your cube where you sort of had, you know, go you know, one step away or go the complete diagonal step. I did the complete diagonal step for a short time and I must say it was a mistake. So I went straight from AMT to work for an organisation called Planet Ark. And I became their head of research. The research team was a team of one. And I really enjoyed that that opportunity, you know, and again, it was one of those things where people sort of say, how on earth did that come about? But in fact, I was... As it turns out, there are a lot of people who realise that, you know, actuaries, you know, were the smart people at school or whatever, and some people are just willing to give you a go, and that's literally what happened with Planet Ark. They sort of looked, you know, I applied for a job like anyone else would. They looked at my CV and went, oh, how bizarre, why would an actuary apply for this? And I had the opportunity for an interview and so on. So it was a little bit that I got lucky. When I said it was probably a leap too far, I think, you know, probably I hadn't done my homework. It wasn't really the right sort of organisation where I could really add value. While I had a real passion around the environment, it just wasn't the organisation where I could add value. It just wasn't the right fit at all. So for me, not only is it about kind of when you make that decision to move into a wider field about, you know, knowing that you can, you know, build on your skills gradually, but actually knowing that you're going to the right organisation with the right fit, and sometimes you might need to move gradually in to better understand the market and the sector to know where you really, really want to go. So I moved overseas. This is the bit where you go follow your passions. I actually fell in love with an Englishman, so not really the follow your passion story, but whatever. And moved to UK. And when I was there, I took the opportunity to work for an organisation called Calland Consulting, which specialised in providing advice to governments in a whole range of different transition countries, so post post Glasnost, all those former Soviet countries, as well as Africa and so on, that were going through major changes in their social security systems, their age pension systems, etc. So that time that I'd had at AMP lobbying government around how compulsory superannuation would work in Australia gave me the opportunity to go into a whole range of countries over the next 5 years to actually advise governments and so on, funded by USAID, UK Department for International Development, all these sorts of organisations, to advise these countries around some major reforms that they were going through. Really, really loved that role, and just one day just really, really desperately wanted to come home, back to Australia. England's pretty crappy weather. And also, while I was there, and this is the real follow your passion moment, while I was working in Russia, our office manager had her mother needed kidney dialysis. And at the time, there were a total of 10 dialysis machines in Russia, which is a population of 170 million, isn't really enough. And to use them, you actually had to pay out of pocket $10,000 a go. So unfortunately, the family bankrupted itself over the next 7 days, and then her mother died. And for me, it was a real turning point. Sorry, I think about it sometimes. It upsets me even now. It was a real turning point in terms of realising all this long-term planning I was doing around, gosh, I don't know why I'm upset now, all this long-term planning I was doing around retirement systems and age pension systems and social security systems, it was all very important and very actuarial and so on, but actually there was a whole world of health financing systems, health systems that just were not functioning globally. And I was convinced that somewhere, somehow, I had something to contribute to that story. And it's what brought me back to Australia, was actually to work for PwC with someone called John Walsh, who was doing a lot of work around health system reform, health financing reform, disability financing reform, like the early thinking around the National Disability Insurance Scheme and so on. And so for me, coming back to Australia was about having that opportunity to really learn from someone who I felt was leading in this field. Some people, I then came back, had 8 years at PwC. Some people see that as sort of, a bit of a linchpin in my career. Actually, for me, it was the focus on healthcare. And I always knew in my heart that I wanted to take it back to the poorest people. So a journey has via Three Rivers Consulting, my own company, which was, again, starting to focus on international development, has now brought me to Fred Hollows Foundation, where I really feel that I've got kind of knowledge and skills to really add value to making a difference to people's lives in the poorest countries. So that story around following your passion for me is just, as you can tell, absolutely fundamental. So my very quick snapshot of the top five things in terms of moving into a new sector. Probably number one for me is earn trust. Sometimes, you walk in as an actuary and people automatically go, yep, I trust you're a smart person, I trust your knowledge, but I don't know you. And I don't know if I trust your judgment. So work hard when you get into any new place, wherever it is, to actually demonstrate that you're someone that they can trust. They can trust with a project, they can respect your judgment, that you're going to do the hard work, the hard yards, to actually understand this new sector. It's so important that you build trust with the people that you're going to work with. Stay curious. This is just a spin on your keep learning. Read. If you're interested in science and environment, read The New Scientist. If you're interested in economics and global policy, read The Economist, etc. Just stay curious and keep learning. Always work with people you learn from. It may not be as automatically obvious what you're actually going to learn from them when you go. Some people sort of say work from people that inspire you. My personal view is that inspiration needs to come from within. What you can do is actually learn from others. And when I first started working at Fred Hollows, I was my immediate manager was a former army guy who'd done a lot of work kind of delivering aid in a range of countries, spent quite a bit of time in Rwanda just post-genocide, etc. And part of me is going, there's so much I can learn from this person, and then so much about this person who is completely different to me. I have no idea what I'm going to learn from him. My biggest learnings from him was how to make quick decisions when you need to. He is an absolute expert in that. And in my field now, there are so many decisions that we make every single day. And unlike in the actuarial field, where you get a lot of opportunity to think and reason and analyse, you don't have that luxury everywhere. So, you know, that's an example of, you know, making sure you're always learning from the people that you work with. It may not be obvious all the time exactly what you're going to learn. So, yes, this is my take on your volunteer option. But, you know, and this photo is from Yes Man, the movie. Take the opportunity to do some things extra to your standard role that may just be interesting, give you an opportunity to build some new skills and meet some new people. And you may actually really have some important impact from it. I remember back in 1996, this is a while ago, I was doing some, you know, I sort of got in touch with the Greens. I'm, you know, a fan in having kind of a third force in politics in Australia to keep people honest. And, you know, I'd got in touch with them to see if there was something I could do for them. And at the time, they were just exploring this issue of property developer donations. They had this massive paper book of, you know, all the donations that have been made to New South Wales sort of parliamentarians over the past 12 months, and they were going, we need to kind of understand what's going on. I thought, oh my goodness me, you are kidding me. Like, it's all paper-based, it's a book, whatever. So I spent some time kind of trying to create a database out of this and started to tell a story, and that's where some of the story around property developer donations, which, you know, has been quite a theme for the last decade certainly, really started to come out, like really getting a better understanding of who was putting money in where and who and how. And we, you know, I worked with them and a number of other volunteers to try to, you know, put together a database with good use and analyse it and tell a story out of it. And that really added value to their understanding of, you know, the influence of political donations and decisions that were being made. And I think it's really, you know, had sort of a role and effect to make people think hard about that. Now, I didn't know that was going to happen. When they sort of said to me, here's a book, have a think about political donations and whatever, I had no idea what was coming from it, neither did they. But, you know, saying yes to that and spending, you know, this few hours sort of time and using my, you know, actuarial approach to create a database and sort of, you know, analyse it and sort of categorise it and so on, I think really added value to understand what was going on in the donation landscape. And the last thing, and it's probably pretty obvious, pursue your passions. There's no way you're going to be able to really add value in a wider field unless you're ready to learn more, do more, engage and be passionate about it. So that's my final tip. Thank you.
Hello, this is on. Thanks, Kirsten and Julia. That's really insightful ideas and certainly quite a number of common themes that have come out through the discussion as well. So now we've got the time for Q&A. So if you're on the floor, just raise your hand and wait for the microphone to come to you because the session is recorded. And if you're on the webinar, just type your questions away and we'll get that to us, the speakers here as well. So while you're thinking about all those questions, I might sort of kick off as well. So I guess through that discussion for both of you, you mentioned the importance of learning, and you mentioned about reading lots of books and also learning from people that you work with as well. So I guess from your perspective, how important is formal education in the whole scheme of things?
It depends what purpose you're doing it for. So when I moved in to start working in healthcare policy and reform, after a year or so, I actually decided to do a Master of Public Health, and part of it was actually to put an external stamp on it so that people would see that I was serious, you know, and part of it was to give me some confidence as well. Healthcare has got a whole different language. You know, we think insurance has its own unique language and actuaries have got a whole range of symbols. Healthcare is just in a different sphere. So for me, it was about learning the language and having an external stamp that said, yep, I'm serious about this.
Yeah, interesting actually, because I was going to talk about my own master's experience. Because even though I was a qualified actuary and I had lots of networks and I could speak the language, my volunteering work at Lifeline meant that I knew how to speak mental health, child protection, all of those sorts of human services type lingo that was required to work in the space. I felt like I needed some sort of external badge. And so I did enrol in a master's degree a couple of years ago, thinking that that would help put any gaps that I had in my knowledge, you know, just sort of make sure that I really knew what I was talking about and I had that external stamp. And what I found when I started going to classes was that actually what was being taught was still a bit behind what was actually happening on the ground. And it was actually a little bit frustrating being in class and realising that I actually had more current and more relevant examples to share and contribute to my classmates than my classmates had to share back. So,
were you the annoying mature age student? Is that what you're saying?
Probably.
That's great. We've got a question from the webinar that has just come through. So this is on the gender perspective. So I can see, you know, a mix of gender in the room. So this is in particular for both of you, given you two women here. Do you think it's generally easier for men or women to break the mold?
Okay, I'm not sure. I think that it's probably more likely that a woman will need to break the mould, and she might be bringing some different skills to do that. That's a really tough question. I think for women working anywhere, experiences can often be just a little bit different, and I'd encourage everyone to kind of look at some of the literature around unconscious bias. It's quite interesting. I think if I go to my first sort of tip, which was around earning trust, I think that that's something that I took on board as a need when I moved into a new area to actually build relationships with the people that I work with. And and I listened to your speech and you were very much talking about building relationships and networking and doing all those sorts of things. And perhaps that's something that maybe I was comfortable to do in a new area. I don't know that there's an easy answer. I think women and men both move into new areas and it just might look a little different.
Only that I think we're talking about a mould that as men and women we fit into the actuarial mould, and there's lots of different ways to break that. So I think it comes down to what it is that you're doing. I think it's a really interesting question, and I do find the gender stuff really a fascinating topic. But I know for me, I think breaking the mould was easier than staying in the mould because the work that I was doing was more interesting to me personally. So I think it probably is less a question of gender and more a question of whether or not, so we talk about how causation is not always, correlation is not always causation, right? So we're all good at maths, and people who are good at maths are good at insurance maths, but it doesn't always mean that we all only want to do insurance maths. So whether or not you're male or female, you might want to be breaking the mould in different ways. And for me, that was about moving into human services and the way communities work. That was my interest area, and I still apply the maths to those things, but perhaps if you were a different person, whether you're male or female, you might have another interest area that you want to transfer that mathematical ability across to outside of insurance.
And I guess, just following on, thinking through the themes that have come through in both your speeches, I think one thing that really stood out is the importance of pursuing your passion and really following that. And so I guess, regardless of whether you're male or female, it's more seeing how that all fits in and building a career out of that as well. Yeah. Any questions from the floor? John, Mike is coming to you right now.
Okay. Yeah, hi. It's John from SKL. One of the things that I hear a lot in my job is people who face similar dilemmas, whether they're in consulting or in corporate or they're looking for something, and your ready, reckon, a 5-point plans from each of you is actually really useful. One of the things that comes up a lot is the competing priorities between, okay, income, loyalty to your employer. Where do you start dividing your time and labour and et cetera, those things. You both give pretty clear sort of pathways, but sort of, I'm not saying they're direct lines, there's obviously the meandering. Your analysis with all the different coloured blocks is a superb example in my mind for how I think. Is there advice you would give people who get to the point they're saying, I'm not getting enough of the job satisfaction from the mainstream, traditional, for want of a better term? Is there ways that you can give them links to sort of say you can look for change internally, you can agitate for different work in terms of moving out of a traditional space into human services, I think you were talking. Is there other things that you can give by just, it's that stage where you're starting to feel you need more that is the most common area I get questioned about it for. Can you give examples of people who've done this and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think if there's an opportunity to kind of agitate a little to create some more space in your own workplace to add value beyond, I would really encourage that path. And there's actually quite a growing amount of literature around giving people space to actually, you know, like a half day a week, that sort of thing, to work on the thing that matters to them most, and that you actually get a lot more of them out of them in terms of the organisation and them as a staff member by doing so. And oftentimes when you're working within an organisation, you actually know the challenges better. So if you have to go outside to do something, you've spent all that time, you know, getting used to a new area, a new company, new people, all that sort of stuff before you can add value. Like, it might be a couple of years before you're really adding value. And if you've got an opportunity to do that within your organisation, I would definitely encourage. Certainly, I had that opportunity at PwC, so I certainly, you know, gradually pushed the boundaries of the work our team was doing into new and related areas. Definitely encourage that.
Yeah, that's very relevant. It's people coming, I guess, it's probably more the constraints of a corporate type of environment where there may not be opportunities to do that. It's the idea of having external involvement, the networking with new and different people, that type of thing. Then it's really having the courage to take the step if you need to step out of the corporate. I think is part of that as well.
But also, you know, again, and I still encourage this in my staff, you know, those sorts of volunteer roles, like committee roles, but, you know, I've had volunteer board roles and I've learnt a huge amount through those and created a lot of value and taken a lot out of it. So, and most workplaces would recognise that's, you know, it might eat into your work time, but actually you're both learning and contributing massively and the organisation will benefit from it.
I mean, that dilemma certainly resonates with me. I started work with 3 small children and so I was working full-time and doing my exams and I had 3 little kids at home. And for most of the last, my eldest is 19 now, but for most of my motherhood, I've been working full-time and the sole breadwinner for our family of 6. So I can totally understand that position of, you know, being at a point where you're going, okay, well, I want my work to be something that I love, but I also need to put food on the table. I'm kind of constrained time-wise, so how do I most efficiently do that? And so that's where I come back to my point of thinking not linearly about your career, so not being afraid to take a sidestep. I mean, let's face it, as actuaries, we are paid well. We do have good salaries compared to a lot of other industries, especially once we're qualified. So there is a bit of room to move and be creative, I think, in terms of what sort of salary is acceptable to you and exactly how much you need. But I also think that volunteering is the most efficient way to accelerate your career. So if you can't get the opportunity within your day job to do more of what you love, then maybe you need to think outside the square, think outside that linear ladder and see what you can do within other parts of your life, whether it's within the community, whether it's with your kids, whether it's just something you're interested in, whether it's a social sporting club that you're part of, finding other ways to do other things that you enjoy in your life also makes that day job a little bit more bearable, but also helps you then bring those back into your day job so that you can find more of those opportunities and have a better basis to be able to argue for some more space to do more of what you like within that current role, or to have the courage to step out of that role if it's not meeting what you need and to do something else.
Good advice.
Hi. To what extent or in what ways do you promote being an actuary in your current more diversified sort of career and role?
When you say promote, what do you mean?
Do you mention to people that's what you know what your qualification is, or do you talk about how that helps you do your role or anything like that?
Yeah, not always. Yeah, look, I mean, I run a company called Guardian Actuarial. I often do have to spell the actuarial part of that to a lot of clients and other people in those discussions. But I think it depends on who you're talking to. So, and again, I think, you know, the actuarial part of us is the basis. It's that bottom left-hand corner of who we are and what our careers look like. So sometimes it opens doors for you, particularly in an insurance company or in somewhere where people know what actuaries can do. But often if you're talking to state government people, executives, or non-government organisation people, they don't always know what actuaries do. So saying that you're an actuary isn't necessarily going to be very helpful. So what I've found is that they know that I'm an actuary because I have it on my card and because I work for Guardian Actuarial. Sometimes that elicits some conversation, sometimes it doesn't, but irrespective of whether it does or not, my focus will be on pointing out the value and demonstrating what we can do and listening to the client, finding out what they need, understanding their problem and then helping solve their problem. So whether or not I'm an actuary or an engineer or a social scientist or whatever becomes kind of irrelevant. I'm just Julia Lessing and I'm here to help you, so not always.
Probably similar answer, so sometimes. And it's definitely, it's rare that it would be the first thing that I lead with. But sometimes I find it useful down the track, because if you meet someone new, they're often trying to place you, just trying to work out how you fit in, what you bring to the table, and sometimes it's useful to bring it into the conversation if you realise it would be helpful for that person to understand or know that I understand finance, I understand maths, I understand these sorts of things. Because when you, particularly now, you know, I'm representing a not-for-profit, you know, it's hard for people to actually think, what does that person represent? So it's not the thing I lead with, but I often bring it in at some point and let people know.
I guess the reason I'm asking is because you kind of trailblazers, you know, and making it easier for people to come follow in your footsteps. If they then turn up and say, hi, I'm an actuary, then they'll go, oh, I know somebody who works for, you know, Fred Hollows Foundation, who's fantastic and is saying...
Great, say that over and over. I find that oftentimes I meet people and they say, oh, you're an actuary, or you're not a typical actuary. I don't even know what that means.
I suppose that's the mould that people have in their mind, whatever that means. Different moulds for different people as well. So I guess anyone else has any questions on the floor, or should I go for the next one? There's one more? Okay, yeah.
Hi. What are the things you found useful in gaining trust and building your relationships?
I think for me is being aware of and honest about my own capabilities and knowledge in that area. So, you know, for example, when I started working at Fred Hollows, you know, yes, I understand healthcare and how healthcare systems work and so on. I didn't know a huge amount about eye care, you know, and I had to put my hand up and be honest about that. And so it's understanding how to work with the experts in the field and being conscious of your own sort of limits, you know. As actuaries, we all did super well at school and so we're all bright, but it's also understanding that the person that you're sitting opposite might be super bright as well and might have incredible knowledge in their space that you can really leverage. And for me, it's actually that mutual respect for another person's knowledge, experience, expertise, and being honest about what you bring to the table, but also where you probably need to harness their expertise.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree, and I think that honesty is really important when you are building those relationships and building trust. And I think another thing that's really important is the ability to listen. So the best thing that helps you build trust is track record of building trust and maintaining trust over time. But in order to kind of go from opportunity to opportunity, it's about listening, and it's about understanding what it is that your client is facing, what's happening with them, not just trying to, I guess, sell your services to them, but to really understand and to build that relationship over time, and to treat it as an ongoing relationship rather than a transaction.
So while you're all thinking, I might throw in another question. So I guess you talked about in your various points in life, you kind of moved around different roles and organisations. What are some of the biggest challenges that you've had through that journey, and what are some of the learnings from it that you kind of, in hindsight, think, oh, I could have done this rather than that?
Well, my biggest learning at the moment is that my husband's gone back to work full-time for the first time in over a decade. And let me tell you, working full-time as a mum when you've got a stay-at-home dad to take care of things is very... I had underestimated just how wonderful that was. So the biggest challenge I'm coming up against at the moment is probably not directly around breaking the mould, but just around work in general and around valuing, looking at that whole sort of life picture in terms of how we balance work and home. So I don't know if I'm exactly answering your question, but it's kind of front of mind for me at the moment, is just not just adapting professionally and technically in our day-to-day work, but also adapting in the way work fits into our lives more broadly. And so my biggest challenge at the moment is just learning how to think differently about outsourcing things that I never used to outsource before, and just putting things together so that life ticks along well and adapting throughout that life course.
I'd say for me, two big things. One is letting go of the 95% confidence interval. As I said, decisions get made every day, and only certain decisions can be made with 95% confidence, because there's very few that you've got the time or the data to do that for. But when you can, when you find the decisions that matter enough and you can find that information, that's where the actuary hat comes on and you really add value in terms of actually making some of those strategic long-term decisions. So that's probably the one thing. And then the second thing is probably doing homework in terms of who to work for or where to work. So the example I gave around Planet Ark, just the wrong sort of organisation for me, and in terms of what it focused on. And, I work with Fred Hollows now. I've been at Fred Hollows for 4 years. I actually, when I was with PwC, I actually did some low bono work for them, doing a kind of a global study of the economic costs and benefits of ending avoidable blindness. And for me, that was an opportunity to meet the organisation and meet some of the people in there. So I always knew that if the right opportunity came up, that'd actually be a really great organisation to work for. And, as actuaries, we kind of know the market pretty well. We know the consultancy firms. We know we've got a sense of which ones we might want to work for, the insurance companies, banks, whatever. We've got a sense of what the culture's like. But you don't know that when you're in a new field. So find some way to, date some organisations or do your homework to understand what the culture's like.
Thank you. Any other questions from the floor or the webinar? Yep, in the middle.
How much do you value your institute membership in terms of benefits?
Would you a dollar value or...?
Or whatever values you can think of.
Even though not all of my clients know what actuaries do, the actuarial brand still carries some good weight in the marketplace, and it is essentially what I'm qualified to do without any other formal qualifications. So maintaining my membership is valuable from an optical perspective to the outside, particularly to a group of people that don't always know what actuaries are. I think something that we need to do, and we are doing more of as a profession and with the Institute, is raising the profile of what is an actuary. And I know there's a lot of work that's being done around that, and certainly I do a lot of work in the spaces that I play in to also educate people about what actuaries do too and the value that we can add. But I think as momentum is growing in some of these wider fields, things like, so in my world, of human services, the actuarial investment approach is now a term that is known by a lot of state governments, where we're using general insurance techniques, actuarial techniques, to project pathways of people into the future through their life course with probabilities associated with that, and using that to help inform planning and delivery of state government services. So the actuarial investment approach now is kind of a term outside of insurance that governments know all about. So there's definitely value in that actuarial brand that's valuable.
And for me, you know, working at Fred Hollows, I've gradually learnt the things that I can bring from my career and my knowledge as I go. And so last week, Fred Hollows launched the world's fourth development impact bond. You know, social impact bonds have been, you know, around for a little while in Australia and so on. We've launched the world's fourth development impact bond. Development impact bonds are like social impact bonds, they've been much slower to start. I don't think we could have done that unless, you know, they'd had someone like me in the team who could really, you know, understand how to bring finance and social impact together. And, you know, I've been in there negotiating. The US government is our major investor. I've been in there negotiating with them. Now, I didn't see that this was how, you know, my career at Fred Hollows was going to pan out. I didn't see that at the start, and I'm so glad that I've been able to bring together these two things. We've just launched a social enterprise that we're using to attract social impact investors to iHealth. We've got a, you know, goal to raise $100 million in social impact investing. You know, so for me, having that brand actuary is incredibly valuable when I go in and start talking to the investors. People in social impact land, they don't even know what it means, but I can talk to both fields and it is a huge, huge benefit.
Questions, comments? Anyone want to share about your own experiences?
I'm not an actuary and I'm not a Institute, but when someone asked about, you know, paying a membership, is it variable to what you do? I think belonging to a professional organisation at that level of trust, when you go to talk to your clients or you're building relationships, or you're belonging to a community, a profession that it's trusted, it's got a brand.
And just to reiterate that, we one of the countries we work in is Rwanda, and Rwanda has a very good national health insurance scheme, and one of the reasons it has a very good national health insurance scheme is because there was an actuary involved in setting it up, and I was in Rwanda. I sent her an email. She's a UK actuary. I've never met her, never heard of her, and it was that moment when I realised how important it is to be a member of a profession, because straight away she's like, yes, I want to meet you. So, you know, having, you know, when there are other actuaries around the world, they get you, and you're part of the club, and that's really useful.
That's a really excellent shining example of the collegiality of us as a profession, which is pretty unique, I must say, amongst a lot of professions as well. I might throw another question then, while you all think. I suppose you talked about volunteering and the importance of it. What would be step number one if someone in the audience or somebody, you know, in the webinar wants to really get into this area? What should they do? Step by step guide. Step number one only. I know we don't have the whole day to talk about this.
So I'd just pick something that you're interested in. It needs to be practical. Let's face it, your volunteer time is precious. The spare time is precious if you're working full time, and especially if you're still studying and you've got other commitments and family things. So try and pick something that firstly you're interested in, and secondly you can fit in with your life. And there's lots of small, you know, you don't need to commit to learning how to be a lifeline counsellor, which takes a long time if you don't have very much time to spare. Join a committee, join an institute, working group, sit on something that's interesting to you, and take it there based on your interests and your capacity as well.
And if there's an opportunity to volunteer for an organisation that gets the skills that you're bringing to the table, that's a great opportunity as well. So I had the chance to go to India to work for a small micro insurance organisation that happened to be at that time run by a French actuary. So he, you know, when I sort of reached out and said, look, I'm interested in coming over for a month, you know, is there anything useful I could possibly do? Just didn't really have a sense of it. You know, he's immediately mind ticking over going, oh my gosh, what a bonus. I know exactly what your skills are. I know how I can use them. So that was, you know, really great contribution and use of time.
Any final questions?
Oh, and if there's anyone who wants to do some volunteer stuff for Fred Hollows, please feel free to get in touch.
Nothing else from the floor? All right, we might wrap up. Yeah, thank you both, Kirsten and Julia, for a really excellent and authentic discussion about your journeys, about breaking the actuarial mould. I hope all of us have learned lots from all your tips, and we can go forth and consider breaking the actuarial mould in our own time. Thanks, everyone, for coming.